Welcome, everyone. Nice to see you all here, those of you who weren't scared away by the title. Our speaker today is Dr. Greta Ann Herron, one of our own faculty, and she's going to be talking to us about some of her recent research. Greta Ann did her undergraduate work in biochemistry and psychology at Kansas State and did her PhD in neurobiology at the University of Pittsburgh. Finished that up in 2003, and she's been here at EMU since 2006. Am I right about that? Yeah. She's done a lot of really interesting research in neuroscience, and I know that because I've had the opportunity to stop by her lab on occasion and see her messing around with frogs' eggs and other kinds of things that look really fascinating to me. She's got a long list of articles, published articles and abstracts, and I won't even try to read the titles. She tells us that today's talk is about the role of calcium shutoff in learning to play the violin. I don't even know what that means. but I'm eager to find out. I'm eager to have my mind stretched, maybe even blown, because I think that's really what these interdisciplinary colloquia are intended to do. We come here in order to blow our minds by forcing ourselves to think in other people's categories. And that's a really useful exercise and often generates some real creative thinking. So, Greta Ann, come blow our minds.
Wow, that sets a very high expectation. I thought it was going to be what I did for my sabbatical. This is work that was conducted during my sabbatical at the Krasnow Institute last year. I spent a year up in Northern Virginia in George Mason University. And so the title that is friendly to everyone is Learning to Play the Violin, the Role of a Calcium Shutoff. The paper that we just submitted today is called The Critical Developmental Stage of Eye Opening Influences Calcium-Dependent Inactivation of Calcium Channels in Striatal Neurons in a Region-Dependent Manner. So what does all that mean? We'll take you through first, this is a quick outline of the talk. There'll be a background about the basal ganglia, a part of your brain, and the role of calcium channels in it and in general. I will spend more time on the methods and technology because I think that might be interesting to you. It's definitely interesting to me. And I will show you the results that we got. So both of these, taken and swiped straight from the EMU website, demonstrate learning or using a motor pattern that has been learned. Playing the violin, learning your golf swing, even automating your trip to work in your car is all the role of the basal ganglia in either sequencing motor behaviors, putting them together in what we call chunks. And this is one of the things that this region in your brain does. In order to learn anything, let's just start from the outset and say that for a neuroscientist, what we are interested in when we talk about learning is how does that work? We assume that there's a physical substrate, something physically changes in your brain when you learn something. Something physically changes in the basal ganglia when you learn a motor pattern. And that's what I'm most interested in telling you about is that physical change. This is a picture of a cross-section of your brain, across like this. And what you'll notice is deep inside the brain are some colored areas here, and these are called the basal ganglia. Basal, because they're at the base of your brain, and ganglia, because it's a collection of cell bodies or neurons. There's a very special circuit in the basal ganglia that causes a recurrent loop, the details of which are not important for this talk. However, that loop has the ability to change physically in the way that I was talking about. Today I'll be talking primarily, I'll be talking primarily about the neurons that live up here in the cortex, or the thinking part of your brain, and how they communicate with the first stop off in the basal ganglia called the striatum. In the mouse, unlike the human, there aren't all these totally different parts, but there is a. This is a very similar thing in a mouse model, and you'll notice that, like the different regions in the human, there are different regions in the mouse striatum also. So I'll be speaking about the mouse striatum, but the broader implication is for the human brain. In the mouse striatum, there are two regions, the dorsomedial, meaning in the middle, and the lateral. Those kind of roughly correlate with the difference between these two in the human brain. This is a zoom in of the basal ganglia, just to show you some of the neurons, the cells that are in there. And they are primarily populated. Remember, the cortex is sending information to these neurons. These are called medium spiny neurons for obvious reasons. They are very spiny, and they are gathering information from all over the brain in order to process it for behavior control. Medium spiny neurons undergo plastic changes in response to specific input patterns. And what I mean by that is that these neurons change their properties during a motor learning event. So you could measure from them before or after some habitual task. For instance, if you teach a rat to run a maze, and the rat runs for a fruit loop, and the fruit loop is always on the right, you can measure the change when the rat first tries to find the fruit loop over to the right, and then there's a major change in these neurons as the rat just learns that the fruit loop is on the right and automatically turns to the right. So think of fruit loop, perhaps, in analogy with work, and turning right in analogy with driving your car to EMU, perhaps. In any case, when you sequence those things, these medium spiny neurons undergo physical changes. One of the physical changes that they undergo is a change in the processing of calcium. Now, calcium, you may be thinking of a nice, delicious glass of milk or healthy bones, but when I think of calcium, I'm thinking of the ion calcium, which is a very special thing in the cell. Believe it or not, calcium is toxic to the inside of your cell. Cells actually take calcium and they tuck it away, or they keep it out. They pump it right back out if it gets in. But when it does come in, that makes it special. It feels special to the neuron, and it's a powerful signaling molecule. So you could think of the calcium on the outside of the cell as being the water behind the Hoover Dam, and that there are special gates that allow the calcium to flow from outside of the cell into the cell. And those gates are highly controlled. There are multiple ways for calcium to come into the cell. All of these gates are highly controlled, like I showed you, but I'm going to focus on this one right here, where it says VGCC. That stands for voltage-gated calcium channels, and their job is to allow calcium into a cell in response to an electrical change in the cell. So if the cell, for instance, becomes less negative than it normally is, if it depolarizes, we say, then calcium flows in because voltage-gated calcium channels feel that change in voltage and will open and allow calcium down its concentration gradient, as we say. Calcium signaling does everything in terms of the cell. This special signal signals development. It's very important when a cell is growing and nerve cells, neurons are making connections to their friends. Or it's also very important in learning and memory, a small snippet of which I'm going to tell you about today. It's very important in neuronal cell death. That means when calcium comes in, cells can grow. When calcium comes in, cells can learn or make adaptations that look like learning. And when calcium comes in, it can kill the cells. So how does a cell distinguish between calcium that's toxic and calcium that causes learning? That's a tough question, and science has been working on it for a long time. But the one thing that we can say is that it has to do with the amplitude, or how much calcium comes in, the duration of the calcium influx, how long it's there, and the duration has everything to do with how long it's coming in and how long it's being cleared out, those rates of clearance and those rates of entry, and the location where the calcium's actually coming in. So those things are very important for the cell to be able to tell, for instance, calcium that causes cell death and calcium that causes learning. Back to the circuit I was telling you about a little bit. This is the cortex. These are the cells of the cortex, that outer part of the brain. And here they are sending us a process over to our medium spiny neuron in the striatum, in the basal ganglia. If you were to measure the responsiveness of the medium spiny neuron to a pattern of firing in the cortical neuron, one of the things that you would find is that with certain patterns, that connection would be strengthened. So we would undergo synapse strengthening, which we call long-term potentiation. Potentiation meaning strengthening, and long-term has some specific definitions. However, you can also cause a pattern of activation in the cortex, a different pattern that will cause, for instance, that synapse to weaken or undergo long-term depotentiation. These both require calcium. So how does the cell tell the difference between the calcium that's going to cause learning by long-term potentiation or the cell that's going to, or the calcium that's going to cause the cell to undergo long-term depression? Well, it has to do with amplitude, duration, and location. In this cartoon, we can see that if calcium comes in, but not very much, and then it's cleared out right away, we see that there's no change in the response of that second cell to the first cell. If a little bit of calcium comes in, but it's cleared out pretty quickly, synapse will undergo a depression or a weakening. But if you get enough calcium in the right time, even though it's cleared out quickly, that synapse can undergo long-term potentiation. Okay? So that's an example of how the cell can tell the difference between calcium that causes learning, i.e. learning by depressing synapses, or learning by potentiating synapses. One of the things that I'm going to be looking at today is I'm interested in how the calcium duration is controlled by its off rates, or how calcium shuts itself down and prevents and therefore leads to specific kinds of plasticity or learning. Okay, a little background about how we look at ions like calcium. All biological currents, unlike we think of currents again as electrons maybe flowing in wires, but currents in biology are actually ions, charged particles such as calcium, which I've just been talking about calcium, but I really mean calcium plus two, or sodium, moving across membranes. Okay, those currents occur through ion channels, in particular, for this talk, voltage-gated calcium channels. And all of those ion channels are highly controlled proteins on the surface of the membrane. And to remind you of our analogy, the gates of a Hoover Dam would be equivalent to that. Some of these channels are activated by changes to the voltage of the cell. Again, we're looking at calcium, voltage-gated calcium channels. And if the stimulation, i.e. the voltage change, stays the same, but the proteins stop working, we call this an activation. Does that make sense? Okay. Okay, so this illustration shows you how calcium on the outside of the cell could actually come through a calcium channel sitting in the membrane of the cell, or the the impermeable barrier between the outside and the inside of the cell, and that calcium could actually feed back and do something under here, which would change the properties of that cell. This is basically a feedback mechanism. If calcium comes through, calcium builds up too high, calcium will actually shut down the gate from which it entered. So this is a feedback inhibition loop, and that's what I called the calcium shutoff in my title. The other way to think of this is calcium-dependent inactivation of its own channel. Calcium-dependent activation has been described a little bit in medium spiny neurons, this particular system that we're looking at. However, we don't know very much about it. What we do know is that in a slice preparation, like what I'm about to show you, quite a while back, they showed that there were some age-related changes in calcium-dependent inactivation. So as the mice got older, they found that calcium channels shut themselves off more. But nobody really knows how important that is to the cell. This study is actually a computer modeling mechanism asking what are the most important things going on in these striatal neurons that cause them to behave like they do. And this study found that, again, it's a model, it's a simulation, but it found that calcium-dependent inactivation is probably pretty important for that. Moreover, we have a model in which we get to observe a huge change in the activation pattern from the synapses into the striatum in a particular region. And that is that mice, when they are born, have their eyes closed like kittens and puppies. However, their eyes open on about the 12th day that they are alive. And so on P11, what we call P11, the eighth day after they've been born, their eyes are still closed, and on P12, their eyes open. And that eye opening goes to a specific, the visual information goes to a specific region of the striatum and not to others. So we have a perfect model here in which we have an eye opening which causes a big increase in the dorsal medial region of the striatum, but the eye opening should not affect the dorsal lateral region of the striatum. So then the hypothesis or the question that I worked on last year was, does eye opening change calcium-dependent inactivation in medium spiny neurons? And if it does, then how does that work? This is what I did. These are some of the tools. I'll elaborate on these, but I used a technique called whole cell voltage clamp. I was actually measuring from those medium spiny neurons I showed you earlier, and I did so in cortical striatal slices, which meant that I was able to take that circuit that I showed you and keep it intact and measure these guys in a more native state than, for instance, if we took those neurons apart. Moreover, we wanted to see what would happen with the calcium current. We watched the calcium currents by giving them a voltage step, which meant we're giving them their natural activation, and we would watch what was going on both in calcium, which goes through the channel and feeds back on the channel, and barium, which is right here on the periodic chart, which also goes through calcium channels but doesn't feed back on the channels. So barium is our control for calcium-dependent inactivation. So a typical experimental day would go like this, and that is in the morning, I would do a brain extraction. So we would very quickly remove the brain from a mouse and keep it alive. We would slice it into big chunks and incubate it in oxygenated artificial cerebrospinal fluid. So the brain probably didn't know any difference than it did when it was perfused with blood. There would take some time to prepare the drugs and the solutions, take some time to actually manufacture the pipettes, and then I would spend the rest of the day recording. So when asked for the title of my talk or what I did on sabbatical, one of the quips that came to mind, of course, is that while I was on sabbatical, I used a lot of drugs. So I didn't take a lot of drugs, I used a lot of drugs. If this is a cartoon of what a brain slice probably looks like, although it's a bit jazzed up for popular press, as I'll show you, but this is the body of a neuron, and it has all these processes which go and talk to its neighbors, and you can see other processes coming through. And at the top of this picture, you can actually see a triangle there. That's a glass pipette. It's coming down, and it is going to go and record from one of those neurons. And that's what I did. That glass pipette is going to touch onto the surface of the cell. The surface of that cell, if you think back to my Hoover Dam analogy, also has the gates in it. By serendipitous luck, neurons, cell membranes, love glass, and they stick to it very, very well. So much so that a piece of neuronal membrane will stick so closely to that glass that nothing can pass between the glass and the membrane. It forms what we call a gigaohm seal, which is basically the same as if you were going to take gigaohms is probably what the conductance of air is. So it's very, very tight, a tight seal if we can do this successfully. Moreover, if we get this what we call a whole cell configuration. This is what we would do is we would form the patch, and then I would actually suck on a little tube, and that tube would break this patch open, and I would have access, electrical access, to the inside of the cell, and I could compare the outside to the inside, much like you would a bucket of water if you wanted to measure the currents. If you wanted to know about the holes in this bucket, but could do nothing to look at the holes, one of the things that you could do is fill the bucket and decide that you were going to keep it at a specific level. And as the current flowed out of the holes, you would have to fill the level of the bucket back up. As much as you filled the bucket is how much the bucket is leaking. And so whole cell patch clamp technology is doing basically this on a single neuron. So I'm going to show you a video of the technique. If I counted correctly, I did that about 1,500 times over the year. It was a high failure rate. So these are the data that I collected doing that. Every once in a while, I would get on a cell and I would collect data from it. And so this is the results from the research. Again, just to remind you, I'm interested in how the calcium comes through and feeds back on this calcium channel in this particular system. Now, the data look like this. Up above is what you see is the voltage pulse. So this is basically what we're doing is we're activating the channel. We're trying to get the channel to open. When we do that, what you'll notice is that there's a big dip here. That represents an inward current. If it goes like this, it goes down. And so you can see that there's a peak here. And one of the things that you'll notice is that even though the stimulus that we're giving it, the thing that we're doing to get it to open is still going on, the channel doesn't work as well. You don't see as much flow through it. Okay? In fact, at the very end, even though nothing has changed up here, you're only left with about 60% of the current that you started with. This is what we call inactivation. You can actually give it a break and try it again, and you'll notice that the inactivation lasts for a pretty long time. So the measure of inactivation we're using is basically asking how much is this compared to this. If that number was one, if that line was perfectly flat, we would have no inactivation, and we would have a ratio of one. As the steeper it goes, the more inactivation we get, the lower the ratio is. So if you take a peek here and look, we're comparing dorsolateral versus dorsomedial neurons, you'll notice that there's this inactivation measure. For instance, take a peek at the dorsal medial, these black dots. Those guys show a fairly a moderate level of inactivation, about 50% is left. We take the measurement over and over and over again, and then we switch it to barium. Remember, barium still comes through the channel, but it doesn't shut the channel off. And so that makes sense. We see that the inactivation goes way up. That means that, or I should say, that this ratio goes way up, meaning the inactivation is not working. So the channel is not shutting itself off up here. If you don't give any barium and you just take these measures over and over again, you'll see that it's pretty stable. If you compare the dorsal lateral from the dorsal medial, you'll see that there's a difference. These are quantified down here. In fact, let me do this. In the dorsal medial region, before the eyes open, there's, what we're doing also is we're taking this minus this, because any inactivation that we see in barium is not caused by calcium. And so we don't call that calcium-dependent inactivation. So we subtract that stuff out to find the calcium-dependent inactivation, and that's what we have here. And here's the important part. In the dorsal medial region, where the eyes are going, where the visual information is going to, you find that there is this big jump after eye opening in inactivation, meaning that when the pup's eyes are closed, the calcium channels don't shut themselves off as much as they do when the eyes open. And it happens pretty quick. This is just one day difference. In the dorsolateral region, even though everything else seems the same, there's not really that much of a jump. And that should make sense because there's no visual information, no big changes coming into that region at that time. This is another measure of voltage that we take. We take a ramp, which means we change the voltage very gradually. And the question that we're asking here is, how much are all of the calcium currents? We're not asking how much does it activate, but how well does it work? And one of the things you could ask is, okay, you get this big change in calcium channels shut themselves off more when the eyes are open. Maybe it's just that there's more calcium current coming in. And actually what we see is that there is not more calcium current coming in that explains that ramp. Yes, the calcium currents increase with age. That makes sense. The neurons get bigger. But it doesn't have anything to do with the jump. Okay? And even if you take this measure as to how many calcium channels are open and you divide it by how big is the neuron, then you see that it doesn't really correlate well with the jump that we see. So there's something going on with these calcium channels. The calcium channels shut themselves off more right after the eyes open, only in the region of the striatum that gets visual input. Why? Why? Well, is the change that we see due to a specific kind of voltage-gated calcium channel? Because there's a lot of them, and they all have different properties. So one of the first questions that we would want to ask is, which calcium channel is it that's doing that? Our first candidate were these calcium channels called L-type calcium channels, because they've been known in lots of other cases to undergo a lot of inactivation. L-type channels shut themselves off very well. So we just used a drug called nifedipine that turns L-type channels off. I think you can get nifedipine by prescription. Anyway, one of the things here in the black shadow is showing you what the previous data showed. And in the presence of nifedipine, we don't get the jump in dorsomedial. It doesn't change dorsolateral. And so, hooray, that means L-type channels must be causing the jump in calcium channels. We see a jump, we block L-type channels, no jump. Done, right? Well, to be more thorough, we thought, well, why don't, if the L-type channels cause the jump, all we have to do is block the other channels, isolate the L-type channels, and we should see an even bigger jump, right? Makes sense. So we did that, and that art is in these columns here. So we used a drug cocktail called ISO-L, I called it that, but it was a whole bunch of calcium channel blockers, except for nifedipine. Uh-oh, the jump went away here too. If it's L-type channels and we block them, the jump goes away. If we isolate them, we should see a jump, but we block the jump. How does that make sense? Audience participation time. Any thoughts?
Some kind of interactive effect between two different kinds of channels?
Fred, you should be a cellular neuroscientist.
Yeah,
okay, that's exactly right. Oh, we love cross-disciplinary ideas. That's right. Fred is right. Just like people, we suspect that not only is it calcium coming through L-type channels that shuts them off, but it's also calcium coming through the other channels that are shutting off the L-type channels. So there is an interaction between those two. That's our hypothesis. Okay. Moreover, it doesn't really change it doesn't change the ratios very well either, so that doesn't explain it. Okay, last data set. Could the change in inactivation be caused by phosphorylation changes? These gates, these channels that allow things in, they're proteins, and proteins can often have their function modified by phosphorylation. There are enzymes that go and stick these big obnoxious phosphate groups on proteins, and it causes them to completely change their function sometimes. And so we knew the calcium channels were subject to phosphorylation. We knew that phosphorylation changes had something to do with learning. We don't know very much about what, but that was a good guess. And so we actually used more drugs to block a whole cascade of phosphorylation, and we also eliminated the jump by the phosphorylation. So that's a lot of mechanism. It must be L-type channels, but it's an interaction with L-type channels, and it must be something to do with phosphorylation. So just to bring it all back around, that is, plasticity in neurons of the basal ganglia is a physical substrate for motor learning. I didn't show you that data. I'm making that argument with you now as background. Plasticity is caused in part by calcium amount, duration, and location. Again, we have good evidence for that. Inactivation of calcium channels in the basal ganglia determines the duration of the calcium channel. So that's the background on which I showed you the following data. We found that this shutoff, calcium-dependent inactivation, calcium channels shutting themselves off, increases right after a big change of input into the basal ganglia from the visual system. And it's specific for the region that receives visual input. And we showed that this CDI has to do with cooperating types of calcium channels and with the phosphorylation state of the cell. So here's my lab. This is Avrama Blackwell, my lab hostess and colleague at the Krasnow Institute for Advanced Studies. If you're interested in this, she's going to come and talk to us in the spring for a pseudoscience seminar. Some of the colleagues I worked most closely with is Rebecca Coleman Evans, graduated and had a baby within a few weeks of each other, and it was her project that I took over. Sarah is the one that you heard on giggling with me in the on the video. Andrew was a modeler, and so is Sriram. I think that Avrama will probably talk about Sriram's work, because his work on the computer explains how Parkinson's causes a tremor. So that would be very interesting. Okay, are there any questions?
Greta, and you talked about strengthening and weakening these connections. In kind of in general terms, what's the current thinking about making new connections or breaking already existing connections? So maybe more on a macro scale, how much are the cells kind of rearranging themselves as well?
Yeah, that did.
Sorry, and does calcium have a role to play in that as well?
Okay. The best known system for that is not the striatum, but the hippocampus. And I just want to, for a broad audience, I want to make clear that you don't get any new neurons, especially, you do in the hippocampus and the region that's processing smell. But as far as that's concerned, we don't get any new neurons once they've been developed. So any learning that happens, any physical substrate of learning that's laid down in the brain would have to take place in the rearrangement of the connections. And so synapse formation is what we would say about that, or synapse elimination. In the hippocampus, which is very well described, we have some beautiful imagery showing in vivo in a behaving mouse, when the mouse learns a specific task, that you can actually see a synaptic connection reach out and make another connection. As far as I'm aware, we don't have that data, those data for the striatum. We can't see those physical changes. We do know that there are physical changes, i.e. synapse changing, in the striatum. But a lot of it has more to do with the moderation of the synaptic contacts that are there. What does calcium have to do with that? Calcium is absolutely required for both LTP and LTD in the striatum. The things that activate the hippocampus, which I don't know if you guys, the hippocampus helps you navigate your way to your car in the parking lot, and it also helps you lay down brand new memories. Perhaps way back there in your Psych 101 memory, you learned about HM, who had both of his hippocampi removed and couldn't make new memories. We know that if you give it a very hard input to the hippocampus, calcium will come in, calcium will bind with specific enzymes, those enzymes go and do something else, that go and do something else, that go to the nucleus that rearranges the cell. If you give a low, slow, and steady set of inputs to the hippocampus, you'll find that calcium comes in through different mechanisms, does different things, but then rearranges the cell and causes LTD. In the striatum, if you give it a really hard input, it actually shuts everything down and you get LTD. No one could get LTP in the striatum in the labs until my colleague, Sarah, showed that actually, if you use more natural patterns of input, like what we call theta rhythm, where it goes bup 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 bup, instead of you can actually get LTP in the striatum. And that was just published this year. Absolutely required calcium, and it depended on the timing, the duration, and the location.
Kind of a big picture methodology. I wondered about extracting mouse brains is, and then it's really messy, right? It's physiology and anatomy and these sorts of things. And it seems like you're, well, I don't know, how well would it work, you know, for example, to take this channel and put it into Xenopus or something like that and try to do the same sort of thing? Or I don't know, what are the costs and benefits of using this very messy system where it seems like, what was your success rate? It was 10%? Less than 10?
Probably less.
Okay. And probably having a better success rate in a more simplified model, but anyway.
Steve, you touch on something that's very interesting for us to discuss with the public at large, as scientists, and that is the trade-off between control and realism, right? Reductionists like I like a lot more control, right? But the more control you have, the less realism you have. My lab here at EMU uses frog eggs to answer questions like that, as you alluded to. I could take out these calcium channels. I could put them in the frog egg where it's not near its neighbors, and I don't have to worry about using all those drugs to block all those other things that are in the cell. And I could look at calcium dependent inactivation directly. However, one of the things that's really important for CDI is that all the little calcium binding proteins and everything like that are present too. So I'd have to build up a system. It can't be completely simplified like that. One of the things that I really appreciate about my sabbatical is that I was able to move up an entire level out of reductionism, right? I moved from a frog egg holding a single channel into a real brain that had all the channels and it had all of its connections to its neighbors. It actually, the synapses still function, et cetera. So I traded off some of the control for some of the messiness, if you will, for the more realistic situation.
So your talk was about memory causing physical changes. I wonder if you can comment about the opposite effect, physical changes affecting memory. So the obvious is loss of memory, but what about forming memories that never happened or something like that?
Oh. Well, as a neuroscientist, one of the things that I'm teaching my students is that we really live in a made-up world anyway. As we're walking through, we think that we have all this control, but we're learning that all the control actually happens below the cortex, coming from the basal ganglia, for instance. Also, our sensations and things like that are just kind of our brains taking pieces of the outside world and throwing and kind of patching them together the best we can. But as far as the basal ganglia is concerned, without waxing too philosophical about mind-body interactions, right, which I'd love to, but we'll stay here on the physicalism plane and say that the things that happen to us as we experience and our behaviors all come from the physical expression of our brain. I will talk a little bit about what happens when this circuit goes awry. So the basal ganglia circuit that we saw is the one that fails in Parkinson's disease. We lose a major input into the basal ganglia for Parkinson's disease. And the symptoms of that are like hypokinesis, the ability to start motor movements. Huntington's disease is another disease that affects the basal ganglia. In this case, one of the inputs fails that is keeping it down, so there are unwanted movements in Huntington's disease called chorea. But we also think that the basal ganglia is important in addiction. Well, we know that pretty well. The basal ganglia is important in addiction because it's a behavior chooser. And we also think it's important in schizophrenia because it's kind of like we believe that some of the hallucinations and things come from a failure of the basal ganglia to tamp down that. So it's an indirect answer to your question, but it is what we know as far as science is concerned.
Hello, Dr. Heron. I just wanted to clarify with the title where you said learning to play the violin. Just to clarify that you were saying that neurons undergo this plasticity, and is that the reason why you can develop memory or... like you said that we don't make new neurons, we just have them and then they grow bigger based off of that plasticity. So I just wanted to understand the connection between everything that you discussed in learning to play the violin.
Well, they don't even grow bigger. It's just that their synapses either strengthen or they grow. So I'll go over to this picture right here. For instance, if there were plasticity between the cortex and the medium spiny neurons, you wouldn't get more cortical cells sending more of an information. You might get an easier time to send information from that single cortical neuron, or you might get an easier time of that medium spiny neuron to hear that information. So it could be presynaptic, a greater release of, for instance, neurotransmitters, or it could be postsynaptic, some sort of adjustment to the sensitivity to the same amount of neuron. And I'm talking about long-term potentiation. Okay, we can see those changes take place, for instance, when an animal learns a habit. We can actually cause those changes to take place and see the animal's habit develop with a new technique called optogenetics, where we put, for instance, light-activated channels into a medium spiny neuron, and we shine a light on it. All of a sudden, we're activating all the medium spiny neurons that are taking place. And we can change an animal's behavior that way by shining a light. Turn the light off, the animal goes back to its non-habitual things. So the connection between motor learning and the corticostriatal synapse is pretty strong. Was that helpful? Okay.
So I'm trying to get the fundamental thing that you're chasing. And it strikes me that there is this insight that calcium has a lot to do with the way this stuff works. And you're trying to isolate it to know what is cause and what is effect. Is it likely that it is one of those core things, or is it just one among gazillion other things that come into play with how effective that communication structure is?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. That's a good question, and that's a question that you should ask every scientist. Is what you're doing, especially if it's reductionistic, is what you're doing really that important, or is it just something that you found that just happens to happen, but it, you know, doesn't change anything? These are kind of details about what's going on. However, I will say that some of the background information is that this is following up a computer model that had some of those things competing and found out that calcium-dependent inactivation came out to be the winner of those things that are competing. So I will say it's more important, for instance, than fast sodium inactivation in the in this particular model or this particular paradigm. Does that prove it? No. In fact, you're bringing up another thing that no one else brought up, and that is, this is a correlational study. So what we did is we changed one thing, and we watched another thing changed. We changed something that we thought had to do with it, and we saw another thing change. But this isn't actually causation. We would have to go in and tweak those things. So this is only one small step in the big picture, but it's big enough. It's going to get published. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greta Ann. Tara, would you mind introducing next week's speaker or next month's speaker? Because you know him better than I can. Dan, right? Willingham?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So Dan Willingham is coming November 19th, I believe that's the Wednesday. He is a psychologist over at UVA. He does cognitive and behavioral research into the ways in which we learn. And he was featured a couple of times recently on Virginia Insight. The one over the summer was ways to encourage your kids to read during the summer. So he is coming to speak somewhat in response to the common read.
The Shallows.
And he's looking at the ways in which the research on whether or not using technology improves or doesn't improve learning. So he's specifically speaking about technology and learning and reading. And he seems very personable, so I think it'll be a good presentation.
Good, thank you. See you all next month, and tell your friends.